And finally, we have Tor Simonsen. Okay. Tor has a Master's of Science degree in electroacoustics. He has a PhD in musicology. He currently is a professor at the Norwegian Academy of Music. And in addition to his work with the Norwegian Musical Heritage Project, which we'll hear about, he has spent a lot of time rediscovering the history of historic Norwegian folk music. Tor melds his academic career with a career as a producer and engineer of classical music, and he operates a label, Cymex.
Glad to be here to be able to talk about my favorite project, the Norwegian Shellac project. What you just heard was a small sample from that, a not well too known opera singer trying his luck as a crossover artist on a well known hit song from the US in the early 20s. I hope I can be able to say something about this in my Scandinavian English. Hope you understand me. I will say something about the archive situation in Norway, and then I will talk about the project and show some samples. Now, first, the archive situation, which is quite bad in Norway. The first attempt to make any musical collection there was in 1927, where the National Library in Norway established something they called the music collection, which was mainly about scores and printed music and some recordings. The first real collection was established some years later when the Norwegian State Radio had to build their archive for their own transmissions, and that was about it. We had to move up to the World War II later to find some private collectors who was taking care of the oldest recordings, and we had to go up to 65 to find that we had an official sound archive in Norway. It is a part of the National Library once more. So we can skip that. So we can say that the knowledge about acoustic recordings in Norway is mainly in the black. And of course, the knowledge about the artist then, which is more my concern. So, the status is that the acoustic recordings resides mainly in private hands. Electrical shellacs, somewhat better represented in official archives, and of course we have no discographic standards, we have no central catalog for what's there. So enter the Shellac project. Established in 2004, as a research project within the academy's research portfolio. The goal was or is to document all recordings made by Norwegian artists or Norwegian-born artists or artists who worked in Norway at that time. And the number of those recordings is very difficult for me to have an idea about. I can imagine that we are talking about between 10,000 and maybe 25,000 recordings, but it's a very approximate estimate. And we are trying to develop a discographic database as well as an open website. I'll tell you about this a bit later. And the goal of this really is that we would like to write the story about Norwegian artists. Musicologists normally write stories about composers. We think as an academy that it should be okay to write or say something about the artist also. So this is the Shellac project. I was looking around quite a bit to see if I can find some other web-based project I could rely on and use as a starting point. I was looking at many of them. Charm, for example, I was in contact with Charm, but I ended up with getting in touch with the Victor database in California. I had the great pleasure of getting in touch with David Sobert. And so he gave me the permission to use this as a starting point. Doing that, I also, so to say, inherited the programmer, Michael Laschutka in Brooklyn. He developed then my version of this system in FileMaker. So we have been working on this for 2 or 3 years now. And we get the recordings mostly from private collectors, and the workflow is now that one of these, the biggest collector in Norway, is coming up to my office with a small box with records. I get them, I go through them, and this is the main work, is then to identify what kind of music is there on the record, the label. We cannot take the label as granted. They lie very much, and it's very much it's research. I had one example. It's on the label. It said "Kissing Duet" from D'Artagnan by the composer Varnet. Okay, the composer Varnet was well known, but he wrote no operas called D'Artagnan, so we had to find out what could they mean, and we found two operas with where D'Artagnan was one of the artists there, and the kissing duet was not a kissing duet, it was a hugging duet, but it takes some time to find all these things. That's most of my time. We have just started to cooperate with the National Library, so I have access to all their holdings and they to mine. I cannot use their catalog, as their catalog are item-based and based on what's on the labels, but I can use the sound and the pictures. So this is the project itself. I will not say too much about the internal workings of the database. I should say two things about it. Obviously, this is a part of the database system. The tables here, and a table with takes, that is what's happening in the studio, and a table of artists, and of course, this just means that one take can have many artists in it, and one artist can participate in many takes. But I have two limitations here, which I would like to talk about. It's about the music. we are taking a very simplistic view, is that the word, of the music here. Music for me is one thing written by one person, just the composer. We don't say anything about arrangers or text authors or anything. And it might be any arrangement of the same music is to be put in this box music. If we have, say, Anitra's Dance by Edvard Grieg, it would be Anitra's Dance, regardless if it were played by a symphony orchestra, or it was an arrangement for violin and piano, or played by four bassoon soloists, heaven forbid. But that is one limitation which suits my material. So we have to take that into account. No further division of work, manifestation, and so on here. And the other limitation here is the same. That one take can go into many objects or items. One item can have many takes, but we have decided, or I have decided, that all the releases are the same. Even if I very much know that one take can be released from 22 can be released in 24, it can be released anew on the vinyl in 74, and the CD in 85, and they might very well be different. They might be transferred in different ways, artificial stereo, various forms for denoising. We don't take that into account either. We look at all releases as identical, mainly because there's very few Norwegian artists that were so big that they made it into vinyl and to see these artists from the 20s, 30s, and 40s. I can think of maybe two or three names. So this is a small part of the tables. It's all together, it's 23 tables. It became quite complicated, but still it's modeled around my view of what is important and not important in this. Some samples from the input screen here. This is the same artist as we listened to when we started. Konrad Arnesen, small time opera singer in Oslo. His name, his date, birth, death. Some text I can put in here and some picture here. I could also add as many files I would like about PDF files, pictures, movies, whatever I could lay my hands on. And his takes, which I don't enter here, it populates automatically when I enter the next screen is the take input screen. The same here, I have some basic information here about the matrix number, the venue, if I know about it, the date, or approximate date at least, and so on. The matrix number, yes. And then I will, before this, I will have to have entered the music, so I can, sorry, I can link the music into this take. This, you see it here. Vincent Rose as the composer, no other names named here. Linger a While as the original primary title and the Norwegian label title, which has nothing to do with Linger a While. Four artists, which all have to be entered in beforehand. Mr. Arnesen, the violinist on the label, she was called Mrs. Haslum. Violin, the first female violinist in Oslo Philharmonic, in fact. Russell Jones, Afro-American banjo player, orchestra leader, drummer, was very much active in Scandinavia at that time. And Alf Pettersen, pianist on the label, he was called Alf Peters to make it more American-like. And then the releases, this just one release on an Odeon, 25 centimeters, and my reference for this, at least a part of this information. Same again, this is the information about the transfer, a picture of the label, and some details about the transfer, playback speed, and why I have selected the playback speed in terms of what key I thought it should be. That's about it. So far we have, just in its very beginning, I have 400 or 500 recordings so far in this system. We can of course make printed output from it. This is a small part of the, I actually like to see things in PDF format or in paper format now and then. It's handy. So this is Mr. Arnesen here, and here is the Lingra Wild recording. But we do also have a web site. I must say this is in its very, in the first days, in the very beginning. Something more has to be done in terms of layout and so on, but it's functional. The links are working, we can go to and fro. Then the various information, still, hey, this Miss Arnesen again. And we can, eventually we will also have the possibilities to play music from it. This is another site with the player in place, and hopefully this will be the big Norwegian shellac site, and then we can start to write the history of Norwegian artists, which is the main goal for an academy. It isn't open. I have a URL, an address. It's called shellac.no, if you care to spell shellac in Norwegian. So that's about what I had thought to say. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. We actually have a few minutes for a few questions. Do we have questions for any of our presenters?
I think sometimes I do find that the question was, is there more degradation at the hub than on the outside of a reel? And I think because the winding tension at the hub sometimes is higher than the outside, that they find that they get more degradation there. But we've found that in maybe two or three of those tapes, and interestingly, those tapes we correctly still identified as degraded, so it may be that even though when you play it back on the outside of the reel, at the beginning of the tape, it didn't show by playback that it was degraded, that chemistry-wise, that it's close enough that we can still detect it.
Yeah. What's the current price of the IR
spectrometer? Yeah, good question. So there were a few things I didn't mention. The price of what we're using is very high, I don't know, $60,000 or more for a big benchtop device. But we just bought one that's also a benchtop device, but you can carry it. So it's maybe this big. And I think we paid $25,000 or something for it. But they sell even smaller versions that are more portable. And I think that if we're lucky at the end of this, part of our charter is to develop an infrared camera that will work to do this process and non-contact at all. And that would be more like $10,000 or something like that. So the goal would be to get a cheaper version. And the other thing I didn't mention is how long it takes to take one of these measurements. And the measurement itself is 30 seconds or something like that, and then the process of getting that data into a computer and analyzing it is super fast. Especially, I assume we would have that basically automated, that once you, if you identify the files that are in the right format to go into the program data processing right now is, takes all the time is taking making clicks. So it's the human processing error, or not error, but time. So that can take, I don't know, 20 seconds, but the actual calculation is seconds. So.
Also a question for Eric. This may have been answered in the statistical analysis, but to me, degradation is a gradual process. So I wanted to know, how did you define degradation as a yes, no?
So I think all of the tapes we're looking at are very old from a tape manufacturing perspective. So these are 20, 15, 30 years old. And there's some information in the literature that says that the degradation of tapes happens within the first few years of having that tape. But I agree with you that it can be a gradual process, and probably is. It's just I don't know exactly how long or drawn out it is before you can say, well, it's actually going to be considered chemically a degraded tape. But my gut feeling is that it's much faster than the time scale of 30 years. I think it's more like 5 or 10 that you start seeing this. And a little clue of that, and maybe this is wrong, but a little clue is, when you do the baking process and you manage to make a tape playable, that, it's a month before that's back to the degraded state. And I realize that you're probably dehydrating the tapes and it's just rehydrating in that process and you're not breaking as many of those bonds. I don't know. I think that we never found any that were really sort of the in-between, and if we can blame the ones in the middle of that blue and red data set as in-between, I would actually be kind of surprised if that was the case, but maybe you could say that, and then you've got, 8% or something that are in that in-between state. So for us, the yes-no is really defined right now by the sound engineers playing the tapes back.
Okay. Because that can also be sometimes deck dependent.
Totally, yeah, I agree.
And then I had another question. I wonder if you also did statistical analysis on other visual inspections that have been used before, such as they are carbon backing in the tape.
Oh, we have focused on the data side of the tape, but I believe that we could probably develop a database that looks at that binder on the back side as well. I realize that some people think that it's all occurring on the backside, and then transfers to the data side in the spool. Is this the wrong answer?
I'm not implying that at all. I'm just talking about a statistical analysis. Correlation, not causation.
Yeah, we have not collected that data. So to give you a sense for it, it took 2 months for one student to collect the 1,600 at least. Sets of or the spectra, because we take from one tape 20 spectra in a very similar area, like two areas on the tape, we'll look at 10 or 20 spectra. So it took a long time. So to do that again on the backside would be a lot of work. We recorded all that. Yeah, we have not tried to correlate it, but we have all that information. We could do that. Yeah, okay, I see. Sorry. Okay. Yeah, and speaking of which, that's really what I'm looking for from you is some feedback on whether you think you might use something like this, what the pitfalls might be, because we're sort of early in the progress of developing it. So if we can take your feedback and make changes now, it'll be more useful for you in the field, because I'm not going to use it in the future.
I have a question. Concerning the degradation of these tapes, what was the condition of the tapes? Were they tight wound, loose wound? Do they have splices in them? Did you find anything that, let's say, you found a batch of tapes of the same run, and some were left library wound, and some were left, let's say, fast wound back onto the reels? Did you see any difference in degradation?
I will say that I did not record all of that information, and I would say that they were not all slow wound, perfectly packed when I got them. I can't make the correlation, and whether they were spliced.
What about tapes that were loaded with splices versus ones that were splice-free? of the same, you know, type of batch?
I also would say I can't say, right? And Gene's shaking his head as well.
Okay.
Okay, so you're saying there are new tapes with no splices. Yeah. So I have not played all of these tapes all the way through. I'm probably not even allowed to. And this is the great part about being at this conference, is I actually get to hear some music. But yeah, I so far could say I can't correlate much to the condition of the tape and how it was mounted or stored.
So do you think that would be a variable you have to add into the survey as you're going along?
I actually don't think I do. If someone had a big data set of tapes and we could correlate it, I'd be glad to try. But what I'm trying to look at is just the chemistry, and I don't believe strongly that the chemistry or the way that something's been wound or whether it's been spliced has a lot to do with whether it's going to degrade or not. I think it's inherent in the manufacturing process of the tape.
As a Northwestern alum, I'm going to put this to our Northwestern friend. There are some interesting things about the different materials the records were made of in addition to shellac. For example, Berliner really used celluloid. I feel that the hard rubber was more of an experiment, an unsuccessful experiment, that the early discs, the thin ones, are celluloid rather than hard rubber. Oliver Berliner and I disagree a little bit on that. Also, during World War II, a lot of the V-discs that we think of as being vinyl are actually a material I believe they called Formvar. And that might be something else to investigate. Dick Sears mentions that in the introduction to the V-disc discography. The other thing is, you seem to be emphasizing phonograph records, whereas, of course, obviously, electrical transcriptions during the 30s and 40s used vinylite, but also used, and in this case, I'm using the term correctly, acetate. Mm. Not talking about lacquer discs. I'm talking about the clay-colored, ultra-flexible World Broadcasting System discs, and some of them do exhibit vinegar syndrome. So we know that they called them acetate, and that's why lacquer discs were incorrectly called that. So there are other materials. I wonder how you would categorize some of those materials and their greenness versus the ungreen vinyl light, as to whether the acetate discs and the celluloid discs might be of a different category.
Yeah, I know I'm kind of painting with broad strokes here, and there are all kinds of interesting experiments with synthetic plastics in the recorded sound industry that I'm trying to track down and pin down. I don't know. I think I'd have to think more about the specific cases that you're mentioning. I guess my goal isn't really to, absolutely categorize, each one of these various formats, with a rating, but just to draw our attention to what might be attributes of a previous network technological infrastructure that have benefits in ways that maybe we aren't thinking about.
Another thing to think about as far as shellac is concerned is that was only about 20-25% of the composition of the disc.
Right.
And some of the imperfections might not be from the
right.
the bug and the tree.
Right.
It's the other crap that they put into the
right.
These 75% of the mixture.
Right. Yeah, the limestone and all the various things. So yeah, it's not I'm trying to make a rhetorical point by saying that the pops and hisses might be reminding us of something useful and interesting, but I'm aware that they're not all doing that. So yeah. Thank you. I'd like to talk to you more about that.
My question was similar. It's like being a chlorinated organic compound, PVC, is an extraordinarily stable substance. Certainly, it proving to be far more than most of the complex tapes and the CDs. But that shellac, being a carbon-based polymer, probably has a finite life. And do you know what the fate of the many of these shellac discs are. I don't, but I do know that in art preservation, most of the artworks that were covered, visual artworks that were covered with varnish now, are having to be restored with finishes that are not organic finishes because the organic finishes are destroying the underlying artwork.
Well, I don't know much about that, the artwork example. But starting to, I mean, for me, it's been very interesting to start to think about some of these issues about media from this perspective, particularly because it brings a kind of emphasis on preservation and making things last forever. It brings that into tension with these other perspectives on, well, maybe it's good that they're breakable, and maybe it's good that we can rework the scrap into, and maybe, you know, that's that kind of emphasis in green marketing and thinking about creating products in a more kind of eco-friendly manner. So I don't think I want to say that, you know, it's not just a return to the past. It's not one or the other. It's not like I'm hoping that we can all go back to making shellac discs, but to maybe work the strengths of that assemblage, that network, where it necessary, you know, where this might be something we can build upon or take into account in one way or another. So yeah, sorry, I don't know the specifics of your question.
Thank you all for your questions. I'm sure that our panelists would love to continue as the conference goes on, so feel free to hit them up as we go along. Once again, I would like to thank our panel. Our next session starts back at 1:15, so enjoy lunch.